2024-50149, United States of America versus the State of Texas et al. And Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center et al. Versus Freeman F. Martin. We'll first hear from Mr. Peterson.
Thank you. May it please the Court, the most straightforward way to resolve this appeal is standing. The theory pressed by Las Americas that it intends to divert resources to counteract government action that it views as inconsistent with societal goals is the theory of standing pressed by the Alliance for Quack Medicine and rejected by the Supreme Court. Like Las Americas, the Alliance argued to challenge governmental action impaired its ability to provide services achieve its organizational mission. The Supreme Court held that argument does not work to demonstrate standing. In Havens Realty, the defendant gave the plaintiff's employee false information about apartment availability, which interfered with the organization's home, referring low-income home seekers to available apartments, and violated the statutory right to truthful information about housing availability. The case does not hold that organizations have standing to challenge any practices directed at third parties that interfere with their mission or societal goals. If this court reaches the preemption inquiry, the court should be guided by three background facts. First, this is a pre-enforcement challenge. And as the Supreme Court noted in Arizona, in this posture, there is basic uncertainty about what the law means and how it will be enforced. Second, this is a facial challenge, and that's a challenge that comes at a cost, requiring plaintiffs to show that there is no set of circumstances in which the law can be enforced. And third, SB 4 contains a remarkably robust severability provision, allowing severance of every application, every phrase, every word of the statute. All of this means that any preemption inquiry would need to be very granular, provision by provision, and require the plaintiffs to show carry their burden to demonstrate no set of circumstances in which application is possible. As the United States publicly explains in the amicus brief, preemption would be based on the text and structure of the two federal statutes at issue, in particular 8 U.S.C. Section 1325A and Section 1326. These are straightforward criminal statutes, not intended to occupy the entire field, and not statutes that create a conflict with the state law at issue. But as I said, I urge this court to resolve the case on standing grounds and believe that reaching the merits of preemption or the other arguments in our brief is unnecessary. My plan is to begin by discussing the facts of the Havens Realty, which is, I think, a key point of dispute between the parties, but at this point, I'll welcome questions from the court.
With that introduction, is it fair to say that Texas is not urging an invasion argument? And if you are, how does that, would it have to come secondary to us saying no preemption?
So, Judge Higgins and I are certainly not urging abandoning the invasion argument. We're not abandoning any of the arguments.
Okay, if you aren't abandoning it, would you agree that we would first have to find no preemption? In other words, if Texas is using its constitutional wartime powers through its judges, judicial orders, Texas court orders can't themselves violate federal law.
Your Honor, I think we may see the hierarchy slightly different. Where the Constitution gives a right to Texas, in this case the state self-defense clause, that right to the state created by the federal Constitution couldn't be infringed by federal statutes. Now, to the extent you're asking about the order of operations and the reversal of temporary injunction, I actually think that's a fairly difficult question. I would say that the state's position is that Judge Oldham's concurrence is correct and that there probably is no strict order of operations when the court is being asked to reverse the issuance of a temporary injunction, because a holding that a temporary injunction should not have issued is not the exercise of judicial power. And so our sense is this court could say the district court should not have exercised the judicial power in issuing a temporary injunction, either because the district court lacked jurisdiction, or because there's a non-justiciable political question, or because there's no likelihood of success. All of those result in the same outcome. Yep. There shouldn't be an exercise of the judicial power I recognize that's somewhat unsettled territory. We do think it follows the first principles. And to be clear, that's different from a take-nothing judgment, which is an issue which is an exercise of judicial power in any resolution of the case.
So your point is the court can pick and choose whether to do it based on standing, PI, or political question. These are options. We're not required to do one or the other.
Yes, what, Your Honor.
That's your position.
Now, certainly, in order to affirm the issuance of the temporary injunction.
Right. I'm saying it, for you to prevail, it's a choice for us. There's no order of operations, and I agree with that. We can do the PI merits, we can do standing, we can do political question, but it sounds like you're in no way rebelling against a political question when you're just saying that, in your judgment, standing is just an easier way for the court to put together a majority. Is that?
Yes, Your Honor, that's certainly.
You're not, whether it's U.S. v. Abbott or this case, a political question win is a win.
Judge Ho, my hope is that this court is going to issue a decision reversing the grant of temporary.
You want to win, exactly. You'll take any theory that gets you to win.
I think that's correct. I'd suggest that for this court's jurisprudence, it would be helpful to have a majority opinion from the en banc court. Anything standing is probably the easiest analysis, because we have the decision of the Supreme Court in FDA versus Alliance for Democratic Medicine. My friend's primary standing argument rests on Havens Realty. Now, as the Supreme Court explained in Alliance, Havens was an unusual case. The court has been careful not to extend the holding beyond its facts. So let's start with the context, which is Havens was a suit between two private parties. You had a private plaintiff and a private defendant. So we're already stepping a little bit beyond the context of Havens itself when you're trying to use Havens to reach standing conclusions about challenges to government regulations. But when we look at Havens, we see Home, the organization in that case, had standing because the defendant gave false information to its employer. And that violated a statutory right under the Fair Housing Act. The claim asserted by Home was under Section 804B of the Fair Housing Act. That conferred a right to any person to truthful information about housing availability. Home's argument was fairly simple. Home's organization is in person.
You said standing is the easiest, but it's also jurisdictional. So we have to decide that before we would get to any merits issue. If we concluded that there was standing, we would get to the merits. But if we concluded there wasn't, we would have to be done, right?
I'm not entirely certain that follows, Judge. And that's because the holding that a temporary injunction should not have issued, as we see it, is simply a holding that the district court should not have exercised the judicial power in this manner. Now, this court obviously has to assure itself of its own jurisdiction. There's no question of that. This court's jurisdiction has not been challenged. So this court has jurisdiction to review the district court. But if this court were to hold, the district court should not have exercised the judicial power in granting a preliminary injunction, we don't think the court needs to start and first say we need to ask whether the district court had jurisdiction to enter a temporary injunction.
But if the people down below don't have standing, that ends it.
That's certainly true.
Okay. That's the point that I'm making.
Well, but I think what's being appealed to this court in order of granting a temporary injunction, and the question is, does this court necessarily have to rule on the district court's jurisdiction in holding that a temporary injunction should not have been issued? I recognize we're in somewhat uncertain testimony territory, and I'm making an argument from first principles about what it means to exercise judicial power and whether this court needs to review that.
Well, it might be helpful to talk about standing, but wouldn't it also, for the court to issue an opinion if it were so inclined on standing, it would also perhaps be important for the court to issue an opinion on temporary injunctions, perhaps, given that that's a topic of some confusion in the jurisprudence. Is that true, and how would you address that?
Chief Judge Elrod, my apologies. Which aspect of temporary injunctions?
Whether this was a proper use of the power of the district court to grant an injunction of this sort?
I think so. But to be fair, that holding would probably primarily focus on the likelihood of success. And I do think that's an area in which holding by the en banc court
would not matter as much. In this context,
it may not have the same broader importance. To be fair, it's very important to the state in this case. This is an exceptionally important statute for the state. It was enacted for very important reasons. It is important to have the preemption inquiry right. I'm not in any way suggesting that we do not want a decision on the merits of this court on the likelihood of success analysis. And it's important.
If there was no standing, why wouldn't that be advisory?
Because the court's holding would be that the district court should not have issued a temporary injunction. District court shouldn't have exercised its judicial power in that manner. They both lead you to the same place. You both end up in the conclusion that the district court should not have granted a temporary injunction and that the issuance of the temporary injunction should be reversed.
Well, that's what we did in Abbott, right? In Abbott, we specifically dealt with the merits and avoided the jurisdictional political question issue. Rightly or wrongly, that's what we did. So it's already our court's practice.
I believe that's the case. So, Chief Judge Elrod, I think the preemption inquiry would be important. It could provide very helpful guidance. We're not trying to steer away from that. But we also, frankly, just think that standing is the easiest issue because we have FDA versus Lyons and Kraft Medicine. Let me refer to Haven's just quickly, because I do think it's important that the Supreme Court and Lyons pointed out that Haven's Realty involved Haven's providing Homes black employees false information about apartment availability. And when Haven's gave Homes employees false information about apartment availability, that's when Haven's impaired Homes' ability
but,
to provide housing.
But in that example, Home was a third party. They did not give false information to the employee as an employee of Home. The employee was acting as, I'm in the open market for housing. And Haven's Realty made a misrepresentation. So it was not because there was no connection from that from between the representation and the status of the employee as vis-a-vis Home.
Clarify, this actually came up in oral argument in Haven's Realty in the Supreme Court. And I think the evidence is there was no evidence that the defendant knew that the employee was connected to Home. But there's also no dispute that the employee was acting in the course and scope of her employment for Home when she was given false information. Holmes' theory was its rights under 804D is denied.
Well, the discussion in the case did not go off on employee status. There was a big discussion in the case about whether a person who is not involved directly can be, whether they're right, they have a cause of action under the statute. The Supreme Court said yes. Even if though they're not directly injured by the violation, the statute says any person. And so they gave them the right to sue, not because it was made to their employee.
I think we may read it differently. I encourage you to take a look at what Alliance said.
I'm looking at what Holmes said.
Well, I suggest you have a fairly short analysis of the organizational standing in Home because the organizational standing was so straightforward. Holmes said it was any person. When false information was given to its employee, Holmes was deprived of its truthful right information, and then you would conduct essentially what is a transunion inquiry. Is that statutory right connected to an actual injury? Holmes had interest in that information. It didn't have some academic interest. It needed to use that information in order to refer low-income people to housing.
But not to prefer its employees. That was the whole point. The employee was taking a standing in as a client, essentially, of Home, because Home didn't care. His employee wasn't looking for Home, and they weren't worried about their employees getting housing. They were worried about their clients getting housing.
Well, right, and in order to do that, and this is how the Supreme Court explained an alliance, in order to do that, Homes needed truthful information about housing availability. Homes' employees were being lied to. It couldn't actually...
So you think if the employee had not been employed by Home, the case would have come out differently. Is that your position?
Absolutely, Your Honor. According to Alliance, they said Haven's Realty was like a retailer suing a manufacturer for being sold defective goods. So by that analogy, you can think of Home as being a retailer of truthful information about housing availability. That's what it's using. That's how it's directing low-income home seekers. And how is it being sold defective goods? Well, it's being sold defective goods when the owners of apartments are lying to Home and its employees about housing availability. So it's being deprived of this truthful right of information that it needs. And if these owners of apartments, if the homeowners are lying to Home, then Home cannot have truthful information about housing availability to refer low-income home seekers.
Mr. Peterson, I have a question about the majority opinion in this case. I'm looking at page 650. And the panel majority says...
Speak up, please.
The panel majority says, on page 650, that this is just like Havens, because the director of the Department of Public Safety lied to the public when he said that he would enforce the law, because the law was preempted, and he obviously couldn't enforce the preempted law. So there, this is no different from the injury in the present case, because when Texas enacted the laws, I'm reading from page 650, the director of public safety said to the public that it has lawful authority to enact it. So how is that lie different than the lie in Havens?
Well, first of all, we've discussed it's not a lie at all. Implicit in that's our presentation about the truthful authority to enact the law. It's pretty much a generalized sort of statement about the law. It's not information that anyone needs to conduct their business. Home and Haven really very much involves something approaching a traditional tort, a misrepresentation made directly by a defendant to a plaintiff. And some of this court's cases have read Haven's written more broadly. Alliance of Craft Medicine makes clear that organizations, no matter how lawful their goals, don't have the authority to spend their way into standing by opposing policies that they disagree with. We want a concrete interest. And Chief Judge Elrod, you asked about a ruling on the merits versus a ruling on standing. One of the things that the Supreme Court pointed out in Alliance is that standing doctrine serves to protect the autonomy of those who are most directly affected by state laws. One of the goals here is making sure that people who are actually regulated by the state laws issue are the ones whose voices are being heard who are challenging this. This is not a case where the plaintiffs are directly subject to the state law issue. They're not directly subject to federal law issue. They may passionately disagree with them. They may want to spend money on services opposing what they see as the outcome of those laws.
Well, home was not directly regulated either.
It wasn't, but then when you, I think the Supreme Court's retail and manufacturing analogy in, well, actually, so two points are on that. First, let me say, home is asserting a statutory right under federal law. Holmes' theory was 804D, I am in person, and you have deprived me of my right to truthful information. And it was essentially undisputed that they had done so. There's an amicus brief filed by the United States in Havens Realty, which I do think has a helpful discussion of the standing analogy there, and said essentially this is very straightforward. The organization is a person. You have committed a deprivation of the employee of their statutory right to truthful information. That employee has standing to sue under the Fair Housing Act because that employee has been deprived of their right, then the employer surely does as well.
Well, why wouldn't we just on the jury? I have a few merits questions because it seems to me, but I will say why I think we do get to the merits. The district court made very explicit jurisdictional fact-finding determinations. Seems to me far more than a perceptive impairment. The district court said, Las Americas, quote, SB4 will completely change the manner in which plaintiffs must reach, counsel, and represent non-citizens as they navigate the federal immigration process while in state prison. That is a jurisdictional fact-finding that has nothing to do with manufactured or self-inflicted injury. That is far more than a perceptible impairment. It'll completely change the nature of their pre-existing services.
So respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of work in that sentence is being done by the word must. And that's the problem there. It's the district court's findings about must are premised on, to the extent that Las Americas would like to continue achieving its societal goals with the same level, with the same degree, with the same results, it must, in response to state law, modify that in order to modify its practices, in order to continue ensuring that individuals...
So if Harris County enacts a restriction on gun rights, are you saying gun advocacy and litigation organizations can't...
We're not going to reset anything electronically at this moment in the courtroom, given our precarious state. But I believe Judge Higginson was asking you a question, and if we could just start there. And we do apologize again to all the participants and to you especially, sir.
Certainly. Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Higginson, look to the Eighth Circuit's decision in Iowa versus...
In Byrd, yeah.
You asked about field.
Field preemption, would we conflict with Byrd? And then I'm not going to do a four-part, just two-part question. Factually, on conflict preemption, reading the injunction hearing below, Texas took the position to avoid conflicts with Mexico, that if Mexico would not accept back a returned person, that Texas would then drop the SB 4 prosecution. Is that still the position of Texas?
Let me answer those one more.
Yes.
So field preemption with Byrd, no. Byrd is a conflict preemption case, not field preemption case. Would there be a split with respect to conflict preemption? In part, the Iowa statute had the illegal reentry provisions equivalent to Texas 51.03. It didn't discuss an equivalent to Texas 51.02, the illegal entry provision of our law. And I'll note that there is a pending petition for rehearing en banc in that case.
Okay.
With respect to dropping the SB 4 prosecution, my understanding is, and I don't mean to be inconsistent with what we said previously, our interpretation of 51.04 is that it requires a refusal to comply with a return order, and if a person cannot return to Mexico, if Mexico will not accept them, then they have not refused to comply. So it assumes that it is possible for a person to comply with the return order, but if they cannot comply with it, they have not violated the return order.
Thank you.
I'd like to answer your earlier question as well with respect to standing. So you think it's an excellent one. It's very easy to set out a hypothetical involving a gun rights organization very close to the circumstance here. You might have a gun advocacy organization that provides services in the form of individual training and education about firearms laws. It's going to provide services to members of the public telling them about the gun laws. It might strenuously oppose new gun regulations. But the fact that it simply chooses to tell people about the laws, and when there's a new gun regulation, it's now going to tell people about additional laws and develop new educational materials, we would say that does not give rise to standing under Alliance for Democratic Medicine. That's simply an organization voluntarily spending its way into standing. And keep in mind, if that were correct, it would truly open the floodgates for standing. That creates the possibility of just forming an organization that says our mission is education about criminal law. And suddenly that organization would have standing to challenge any new criminal law anywhere in the country, because that organization is going to be spending additional money in the form of services to educate people about the new criminal law after it comes out. And I think the organization can make the same sort of empowerment and mission arguments as well. Say, my mission, my goal for society is to get the American public fully educated about criminal laws. The imposition of new criminal law means that I have to tell people about the new criminal law so that they will be fully educated, they'll be less fully educated if I tell them about every criminal law other than this one. And that's just the sort of floodgates for standing that the Supreme Court was trying to close in Alliance for Democratic Medicine. I'd say what we truly want here are individuals with a concrete interest. We haven't spoken much about the merits of the preemption analysis. I really would suggest to you the amicus brief of the United States, because I think it does an excellent job of focusing in very granularly on the federal statutes in question. In particular, if you look at 8 U.S.C. Section 1325A, it states any alien in subsection 1 who enters or attempts to enter the United States at any time or place other than as designated by the immigration officers shall be punished. That's it. There are not federal defenses to that crime. There's not a suggestion in statute passed by Congress that any change in an alien status is an affirmative defense to that crime. There is nothing in the statute passed by Congress that says if you are subsequently granted asylum or apply for asylum, you are not guilty of a violation of 8 U.S.C. Section 1325A. It's simply a crime, plain and simple. And now it may well be that a particular executive administration may choose to enforce that crime passed by Congress in a way that is affected by determinations on the civil side of the immigration laws. But nothing in the statute passed by Congress directs the executive to do that. Nothing in the statute passed by Congress suggests that Congress meant anything other than what it said, which is entering the United States at a time or place other than designated by immigration officers is a crime, full stop. So we see this as essentially in the heartland of Kansas versus Garcia, where you have two different sovereigns criminalizing the same conduct, and the possibility that the federal government may exercise prosecutorial discretion is simply inherent in the fact that it's possible for the state and federal government to make the same conduct a crime. That's I do think the easiest way of resolving this would be on standing grounds. We urge this court to apply lines for democratic medicine and reverse the granting of temporary injunction on that basis.
Thank you. We have your argument, and we've saved time for rebuttal. We'll hear from Mrs. Watson. Is it Wofsy?
Wofsy, yes. Thank you, Your Honor. Is that loud enough?
That's good.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Cody Wofsy, ACLU, for the plaintiffs. Every court to have addressed laws like SB4, and indeed every judge outside of this circuit, has deemed this to be likely preempted by federal law. And when the Supreme Court turned away Florida's stay application, there were no noted dissents. That makes sense. The arguments Texas is making fly in the face of a 150-year-old drumbeat of Supreme Court precedent, making clear that entry and removal are exclusively federal business. Most of the discussion today has focused on standing, so I'd like to start there. And in particular, I want to start with what I see as kind of the key error in the state's presentation on Havens Realty. What the state is saying is that Havens reduces to a particular fact, namely that there was a lie to an employee of the organization. That makes no sense within the context of Havens Realty. In Havens, the defendant was lying to homeseekers, and the organization, Home, was not involved in those conversations, as Dr. Kim was pointing out. That was directly between the defendant and the homeseekers, and the organization wasn't kind of a conduit for information, like a real estate agency or something like that. Instead, the only reason that the organization got out of lie to its employees is because they sent in a tester who's posing as a homeseeker. But that was to prove the racial smearing. It was not the essence of the injury itself, and that could not be clearer from the Supreme Court's decision, which I think shows that the Texas argument is demonstrably incorrect. Later in the opinion, in addressing the statute of limitations, the court distinguishes between statute of limitations, and this is at page 381 of the opinion. The court distinguishes between the statute of limitations as to the tester themselves and the statute of limitations for the organization. The tester was outside of the statute of limitations because the false information given to the tester was beyond that limitations period. The organization's claim was within the statute of limitations because it was the full pattern of racial steering extending to the latest incident of racial steering, which was a lie told to somebody who was not an employee of the organization. If Texas's theory of what Hayden says was right, then it would have come out the other way on statute of limitations, and it did not. Beyond that, I think Texas wants the court to understand Alliance to have essentially limited Havens to its facts. We've heard a couple of different facts that it wants to highlight. Maybe that it was private versus public. Maybe sort of question of whether it was actually regulated. But that's not what Alliance said. Alliance reaffirmed Havens and distinguished it. In Alliance, the theory was that an organization that was a pure issue advocacy organization could spend $1 opposing a policy and then have standing. But Alliance said that's different from an organization that provides direct services. It would make no sense for the Supreme Court to single out that distinction as critical if what it really meant to say is either you can ignore Hayden's rules altogether or some other distinction that is being drawn today is what's actually the critical one. So I think that Texas is sort of grasping to try and find more in the Alliance opinion that is there. And ultimately, we have to go to the source, which is what did Havens Realty actually say? We're not asking for some standing exceptionalism rule like what the court just approved in Boss for candidates. We're asking for the regular rules of Article 3 standing to apply to Las Americas. Under those regular rules, organizations that are not directly regulated routinely have standing to assert all kinds of injuries, both economic and non-economic. Organizations that are impaired by voting changes, like vote.org, farmers that are impaired by regulations on other farming entities, like in Monsanto, and individuals whose recreational or aesthetic interests are harmed by environmental regulations on others. Of course, it cannot be generalized. There's nothing generalized here. Las Americas is impaired by SB4 in a way that few any litigants could show their working court's questions.
So, Mr. Welshy, you say that the state is grasping in its interpretation, but this court, in a panel opinion issued, as you know, before the panel opinion, in this case, in the Deep South case, said that the Supreme Court has limited Haven to its facts, and that panel of this court also said the Alliance Court clarified that Havens does not support standing where an organization diverts its resources in response to a defendant's actions. Rather, those actions directly affected and interfered with its core business activities. So I suppose you would say that the Deep South panel, again, which under our rule of orderliness was the first opinion here, is also grasping?
Your Honor, I'd like to sort of have three responses on that. So the first is that I think Deep South addressed a situation exactly like Alliance itself, that is, an organization that was pure issue advocacy, was saying, I want to spend money in my issue advocacy, and so I think it was controlled by the facts of Alliance, and so that really would have been dicta. Number two, we do think that that is incorrect and irreconcilable, really, with what the Supreme Court did in Alliance itself. Number three, as to Your Honor's question about the rule of orderliness, you know, I think obviously we're here now at the en banc court, so I'm happy to answer questions about that if the court has them. But I think the question is really at this point for the court to resolve what Alliance and Havens mean together.
Well, how is it grasping to read what the Supreme Court said in Alliance? Havens was an unusual case, and this court, the Supreme Court, has been careful not to extend the Havens holding beyond its context. It's hardly grasping to say that they limited Havens. The other thing is they gave this analogy of a retailer purchasing defective goods from a manufacturer. Well, in Havens, effectively, Home used a secret shopper. That doesn't mean Holmes couldn't have sued the person that provided the defective goods, the untruthful information. There's no secret shopper here, though.
So, Your Honor, in terms of it being an unusual case, I think that that has
to be limited to its context.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor, and being limited to its context. I think that has to be understood in what the court said was the, quote, critical context. The critical context was that it wasn't a pure issue advocacy organization. It was, in fact, a direct services organization. I also think that Alliance, more generally, is a reminder that you do have to go through the steps of the Article III analysis. You need to make sure that you're showing causation, redressability, that this isn't a generalized grievance, and so on and so forth. And so it may be that what the court thought is that in many cases that Havens maybe was applied either, you know, maybe not by this court, as this court has limited it in various ways to, you know, abide by those rules, but maybe by other courts, it felt that it was being applied too loosely, and so courts need to make sure they are checking those Article III boxes. But I don't think that it's a reason to say that what Alliance is saying is Havens can be ignored, Havens should only apply, for example, to this particular kind of claim under this particular statute where there's, as Your Honor says, a secret shopper. I don't think that anything in the opinion supports that. And the court certainly knows how to say that about one of its prior opinions. It didn't do so, and I respectfully don't think it's for this court to say so now. Now, as for the secret shopper,
Mr. Wofsy, yes. I mean, if you've answered his question, what services do your plaintiffs provide?
Yes, thank you for the question, Your Honor.
Yeah, so, I think that's pretty critical.
I agree, Your Honor, and I would love to respond to something said about that. So Las Americas provides a range of services to low-income citizens, particularly those who are seeking asylum or other forms of protection. Yes, information and counseling, also direct representation in, for example, peer interviews, and so on and so forth.
How does that differ from what the ACLU does?
I'm sorry, Your Honor? How does it differ from, for example,
yes,
my job? yes, Your Honor, we have very few cases, and they are typically in the appellate posture. I would say Las Americas,
All right, how about the Southern Poverty Law Conference? How does that differ from them?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that there's a lot of organizations that do legal work. I think that if I understand the upshot of the question, the reason this is not generalized is because we've shown in a factual way the fact that this new law layers an entire new state system on top.
Well, Baker and Botts represents clients who are involved in municipal bonds, and many big law firms do, and it is not unusual for a state or city to change the rules applicable to bonding. And when they do, Baker & Botts has to redeploy its resources to represent its clients effectively. So then how does it differ from Las Americas, wherever
right.
they are?
So, Your Honor, I think this goes to something that the state suggested, which is, well, if all you're doing is just, you know, giving an update about a change, then on our theory, there would be standing. I don't think that's right. The Havens test is it has to perceptibly impair your way of providing.
What's the difference? Is it the amount of money? What is it? How would you write an opinion that would distinguish your client from a big law firm advising about a seminal change in law?
Absolutely, Your Honor. So what I would say is, for example, Las Americas doesn't point to standing every time the Board of Immigration Appeals issues a new immigration law, even though they might need to make a change in some of their documents, whatever. That is sort of baked into the way that they do business. That is not a perceptible impairment. That's a quick edit that's sort of part of course, the law is always changing, so it's part of the job of a lawyer to deal with a lot of changes. The difference here is that this is an entire new system that's overlaid on top of the one that already exists. And so, very concretely, it's not that Las Americas needs to give different.
Well, let's take a law firm that's represented people before administrative agencies for decades, and suddenly the Jarkissi decision is decided. And suddenly they can't go before ALJs anymore, people with whom they have a history, experience, possibly personal interaction, and so on. And now they're dealing with, God forbid, a federal court, which is very unpredictable. They have to redeploy their resources, too, in a very major way, do they not?
Your Honor, I think that there might be a case for standing under those circumstances. I'm also not familiar with a particular kind of way that those places operate, but I do think that that is a very big difference from sort of an everyday change in updating your legal materials. And, you know, I think that for Las Americas here, the concrete way to think about it is, before SB4, their clients who are undocumented people who are seeking asylum and so forth are either out in the community, able to come into Las Americas' offices and get advice and counseling and representation, or they're in federal detention where Las Americas already has systems, already has the relationships and access. Afterwards, they're going to be in state jails and state prisons. That's going to, by itself, make it more complicated, expensive for Las Americas.
But isn't this just diversion of resources? And again, Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine said that's not enough.
Your Honor, I think what Alliance says, and I think particularly in light of cost, what Alliance says is you can't spend money if you don't have that initial harm. And we agree with that. But Voss makes clear spending money, spending resources reasonably, you can call that diversion of resources, spending money reasonably in response to a cognizable harm is a entirely acceptable and cognizable form of Article III injury. And so I don't think that reading those two cases together, you can come away with, for example, the idea that the diversion of resources in Monsanto is not a proper injury. In fact, it is. And so that's the bottom line about Alliance. That in Alliance, in the opinion, the court is clear, the organization wasn't harmed in its pre-existing activities by the policy. What it was saying is, we opposed this policy, and we spent money opposing the policy. That is a generalized grievance. That's an invitation to just have anyone
else
for anything.
Counsel, if I could shift gears for a second, I realize we've been talking about standing, but on the issue of preemption, how does the severability clause in SB4 impact your argument, if at all?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. So I don't think the severability clause comes into play because, as the panel said, every instance and all the provisions of SB4 are preempted. I'm happy to talk about why that would be. I think the most straightforward reason is that they are field preempted. But likewise, they're often preempted in every application and every provision. And that's exactly what the Eighth Circuit concluded unanimously in the Iowa case. Obviously, if the court were to disagree with that in some way, I'm happy to, you know, answer specific questions about severability, but I don't think any of those provisions can be applied constitutionally in any way, and so there's nothing really to sever. There's a few other provisions of SB4 besides the three sort of primary entry, re-entry, and removal provisions, but those are all kind of just have no effect now with those three terminal provisions.
Mr. Wofsky, I'd like to take you back to standing for just a moment. You mentioned earlier that your client provides a range of services, but the services that you've described sound to be primarily legal. What is the range of services that your client provides?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it's all sort of under the umbrella of legal services, but it's legal information, advice, counseling about options, and then representation in particular proceedings, as well as referral to other legal services, for example, for people who are moving out of state. Of course, under SB4, they'll be in state jail, so we won't be able to move out of state.
Counsel, remind me, how many aliens did Las Americas directly represent in the last year for which we have data?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the record says that they, I apologize, I don't know the number off the top of my head, I believe it's somewhere between 2,000 and 4,000 that they assisted in some way. There was a variety of different forms of assistance.
Exactly, which isn't responsive to my question. So, obviously, providing a referral, providing a pamphlet, different than direct representation. So if the question, this goes back to something that Judge Jones asked you, which is if the thing that is differentiating Las Americas from the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine is the direct representation, how many did Las Americas directly represent? They appeared in front of an immigration judge. They noticed an appeal to the BIA. Heaven forbid they ended up in federal court. How many was that for the last year for which data is available?
I apologize, sir. I don't remember that.
I don't see anything in record. So I'm not faulting you. I've tried. Obviously, I've been involved in this case for some time, and I can't find the number.
Yes, sir. And I guess our point would be that actually doesn't matter. In the same way that in Havens Realty, the question wasn't, okay, well, exactly how many home seekers were going to be directed away from this. Havens Realty, remember, was only about one apartment complex that people were being racially steered away from. That's not the question. If you look at Havens Realty, what it says is that it's the impairment to the organizational efforts to try and have equity in housing. And so likewise here, I think the record is very clear that Las Americas for a long time has essentially been in triage mode. That is, they go to where people are in the most risk of being removed from the country without any access to asylum. That's exactly what they did when the Title 42 process was initiated by the federal government. And it's what they're doing, it's what they will do now in response to SB4. I think that's entirely consistent with their mission, their passport, and it is a demonstration of the impairment. I think, to the question about Alliance and how it relates to BOSS, I think of the sort of diversion of resources or spending resources as kind of a way of measuring the initial harm. That if you're reasonably spending those resources, say, in Monsanto to pay for testing to ensure that the crops aren't contaminated by genetically modified organisms, that's a way of kind of making the harm, the initial harm, which is that risk of contamination, a little easier to get your hands around. And so I think here, Las Americas is very reasonably taking these steps to address this brand new system that's being overlaid on top of the federal system, of course, at the standing stage.
On your theory, it wouldn't matter if it was one pamphlet and one client, or 2,000 pamphlets and 2,000 clients, because as you point out, and home. I agree with you. One apartment, right? So it shouldn't really matter, right, on your theory?
I think that's right, Your Honor. Here's the caveat of Connecticut. You know, so obviously the standing rule is, you know, there's no sort of quantitative measure of standing. But the rule coming out of Havens is perceptible impairment. So I think if you're talking about one client, I think a court could reasonably ask the question, maybe this is a factual question in that case. Doesn't that really perceptibly impair the operations of this organization? I think that's why it matters here, that this is such a large system and it's such a new approach to immigration, the state stepping in and setting up its own immigration.
Yeah, you've mentioned the newness a couple of times, and updating materials and totally changing. I'm curious, what provision of Texas law are you going to have to use to be like, actually, now there's this brand new legal requirement that you didn't have before? When you go to update your pamphlets or whatever, or you go to meet somebody in a state facility, what is the new requirement that did not exist prior to SB4 that you're going to have to say, hey, listen, here's the alien registration requirement, here's the entry requirement, the reentry requirement, the removal requirement. What is the thing that you're going to have to tell them about?
So I think that there's two aspects that are new, and it's not necessarily about what we're telling the clients, it's more about how we're providing the services that you're already providing. So one of the things I've already mentioned is the location and access to clients, that is state jails versus, you know, so obviously that's, you know, I think that's clear from the statute itself. The other piece of it is the removal provision, which I know we can talk about what exactly that means, but I don't think that there's any dispute, and this is exactly what the Eighth Circuit said on the face of the provision itself. It says, if you don't leave, you get 20 years in prison. And so what that means, particularly in the way SB4 is set up, where it is, by design, encouraging people to take that, you know, quote-unquote voluntary removal order as early as possible and be out of the country under threat of 20 years in prison, I think that what that means is that people are in grave risk of being removed without any access to asylum. And so that's going to change if your goal, as the organization's goal, is just trying to make sure people have access to the protections that are available under federal law.
Where's the constitutional right to file an asylum application? I mean, access to asylum is sort of, all that means is you want your clients to have something pending for 10 years, right?
Your Honor, the constitutional issue here is a supremacy clause issue. 8 U.S.C. 1158 specifically says that this exact population, those who enter without inspection, must be afforded the opportunity to apply for asylum. And our point is that Texas is stepping in and saying, actually, we disagree. People should be expelled from the country with no opportunity to apply for asylum. That it could not be a more straightforward supremacy clause.
Certainly that could be litigated easily enough if the law ever goes into effect and one person comes foul of it, right?
I think the same thing could have been said in Arizona, which of course is a pre-enforcement preemption challenge that struck down.
Well, but part of that law was not conflict preempted, correct?
That's right, Your Honor. Section 2B was not conflict preempted because the court read it to only require exchange of information which is specifically provided for in federal law. But the court said that provision would have been preempted if it had allowed for the kind of unilateral immigration enforcement that was struck down in Section 6 that this court rejected in Farmers Branch, and that's exactly what Texas is doing.
Before your time elapses, I just want to make sure as a place mark question, are you still asserting a separate theory of standing under Ex parte Young? If so, what do you understand Texas's response to be? On preemption, I just want you to have opportunity to respond, since it's the question of whether this is an exclusively federal field, respond to the federal government's brief here, the amicus brief. Are they asserting at all that they have discretion over Texas criminal proceedings? Are they asserting any Article 4 duty that they have stepped in to assist a state that's being invaded? And I guess, has the federal government at all said that it has abandoned the field of removing foreign nationals?
Thank you, Your Honor. So on Ex parte Young, I don't think it's a separate standing theory. It's, you know, the state has raised a defense that we don't have a cause of action. But our point is, this is an absolutely traditional Ex parte Young claim. Now, you know, I can talk about the details of that, but I think that this court's recent en banc decision, Green Valley, which is essentially unanimous, I think is basically dispositive. Ex parte Young is a simple, straightforward inquiry. It's the same inquiry for both the 11th Amendment and for availability of equity. That's the law of the circuit. That's also entirely consistent with how the Supreme Court has handled the equity question. I think Judge Higginson answered your question about the United States is an amicus brief. I appreciate you bringing it up. I don't understand the United States to have said any of those things. And in particular, you know, the United States doesn't seem to be defending the expulsion provision of state law, and it is not defending the idea that there, you know, an invasion here would allow the state to overcome federal supremacy. I think also, I would just refer the court to the Iowa decision on the United States' amicus brief. Obviously, preemption is a question of congressional intent, and so the particular occupant of the White House doesn't get to decide what federal laws mean, and that's exactly what the Eighth Circuit said.
Would you please address the argument that was made about 8 U.S.C. 1325, is that the right side?
Yes, Your Honor. The preemption argument about that, yes. So I think that it points out a really fundamental misunderstanding of the statutory structure here. So I think both the United States and Texas today are focusing exclusively on this one provision or two provisions, 1325 and 1326, that is the criminal provisions. But as the panel explained, there are numerous provisions of federal law addressing both the entry into the United States and the expulsion from the United States. And what they do, taken as a whole, is they give the federal government a wide range of tools to address the conceitedly complicated questions that come up when you're talking about people who enter without inspection, the policy interests pointing in different directions, and the Congress, as the Supreme Court has said over and over, has squared that circle in this context by vesting the federal executive with broad discretion to decide how to handle individual cases. That is not discretion for the state of Texas to exercise. That's exactly what the Iowa court said. But I think it's useful to take a step back and look at the field preemption question, because if that goes to field preemption, it really would only go to one of the two prongs of field preemption, that is, whether there's a comprehensive scheme. But of course, we know that the test for field preemption in the Supreme Court is in the disjunctive. It's either a dominant interest or a comprehensive scheme. And I've heard no argument from the state of Texas to suggest that the federal government's interest in entry and removal is anything but dominant. How could they say that, given 150 years of the Supreme Court saying it's not just dominant?
But our line of case law involving mirroring laws, where states are trying to help the government. So would it be possible for states along the northern border to decide to help the government and enact automatic asylum application processes? So the flip of this, states elsewhere deciding they want to help the government with its asylum process, so here's availability for an automatic asylum through state laws. What would your position be equally, that would be conflicting with federal exclusive powers?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm trying to think through the hypothetical because I do think it raises some, you know, different kinds of questions. Obviously, there are some things states can do, and so, you know, I'll give you a couple of examples that I want to come back to the asylum question in particular. So certainly, states can do things that constitute cooperation under the narrow provisions that Arizona says state federal law allows states to have a role. That's like this court's decision in El Segundo, for example. States also, of course, have anti-commandeering rights in terms of, you know, not using their own resources for this and that. I think that, to your Honor's question, I guess my question would be kind of how that works, because if what's happening is they're, for example, assisting, providing, you know, kind of financial or practical assistance to non-citizens, I don't think that would infringe on anything, because that's sort of just like, you know, a locality paying for a lawyer for somebody. I can't see how that would be. Here we actually have a regulation about who may or may not enter, what the penalties are going to be, and who can remain or has to be expelled. So I think it's much more of a sort of infringement. I also think, for example, that we're not saying that asylum is a preemptive field necessarily. You know, I mean, that would be an entirely different question. What we're saying is entry and removal are the preemptive field, and those are things that, going back over 100 years, the Supreme Court has said are absolutely central to the sovereignty of the United States as a nation. And so I think that you have to understand that as the context for this whole case. Texas suggests it has those same sovereign powers, but with respect, that's not what the Supreme Court has said in Curtis Wright, in Fold last year, and in immigration cases all the way from China up through Arizona.
Turning back to the standing point, it seems that your standing argument relies a bunch that this is novel, that this is new or innovative or something that, you know, the industry is changing. But couldn't the same thing have been said about the abortion pills case? That the changes in the regulation opened up a whole new way of abortion being taken place across state lines with no medical supervision. And so these abortion doctors, or doctors who have performed abortions against their viewpoints to do so, religious views to do so in the emergency room, that they are having a flood of new, not just new business, but fundamental business, because they're not tied to those traditional providers, because there's no provider anymore. Why isn't that a fundamental change? And that was obviously, as our court well knows, that was not good enough for standing. But it seems that that's was fundamentally changing a situation via regulation. So why would that not be comparable, and why does this work in this context and not in that context?
Thank you, Your Honor. I see my time has started, but I'm going to respond. So I think it's important to understand a couple things about Alliance. First, there's really two standing theories that the court addressed, and I want to make sure we keep them separate. So I think Your Honor is talking about the standing theory as to doctors. And, you know, I don't think that the court disputed the idea that this was new. What they disputed was, is that that chain of causation was too attenuated. That is, there were too many sort of if's in getting from a doctor giving an abortion pill, doctor's not for the court, patient's not for the court, to a doctor in an emergency room somewhere else. They said, we just don't think that chain of causation is close enough. There's nothing like that here. Obviously, the SB4 is operating directly on the consumers of Las Americas' operation and working the market that we are acting in. In terms of...
But they were the consumers of the emergency doctor's operations.
Your Honor, with respect, I understand the court to have said that that is just too many inferences away in Alliance. It's a different issue, and it's not an argument, as I understand it, that Texas is making.
So you don't see there any differences, any comparisons with the large industry, the changes in the law or the industry?
I think that the reason the newness and the change matters is because the test under Havens Realty and under this court's long-standing precedent is perceptible impairment. And I think if nothing's changed, then your businesses or your nonprofit organizations are going about the things it's always done in the way it's always done. And so in some ways, yes, the newness matters, because that's the way you show this action is causing perceptible impairment to the way we're doing business.
Thank you.
Thank you. I ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. A few points.
Mr. Peterson, the plaintiffs rely on somewhat on Boss. I don't blame them. If I were they, in the Supreme Court, you know, 8 days ago, issued an opinion that found standing, I think I'd find a way to use it too. The question is whether they're grasping and trying to do that. And let me just read to you a paragraph that you gave us in your 28J letter on Boston and ask you to elaborate on that. It's just only two sentences. You said, Boss reiterates that plaintiffs cannot manufacture standing by voluntarily incurring costs. It does not support plaintiffs' contention that this rule is limited to lobbying costs and does not apply to costs to provide services?
Yes, Your Honor. As I read my friend's brief, I understood the argument to be that Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine prohibited organizations from acquiring standing by advocating or lobbying against policy positions that they oppose, and that where an organization is opposing a policy by providing individual services, they can still expend resources and divert resources to acquire standing that way. That's not how we read Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. We don't think the Supreme Court's recent decision changes that analysis either. We read that decision as simply looking at the close link between the candidate's interest in an election and the election rules governing that election. And when it comes to the argument about what was happening in Alliance, keep in mind that Alliance did make the argument. We are providing individual services, and our current provision of individual services is being disrupted by the change in the law. They said, we are currently providing services and educating our members about the dangers of surgical abortion. The FDA has changed what it is doing, and now to achieve that same result, we have to not just do that, we have to provide individual services and educate our members about the dangers of chemical abortion. And my friend mentioned the attenuation portion. We did raise this in our work. We cited that portion of the discussion on Alliance, but I do think it has some applicability here. And I think the argument that you heard points injury being speculative with injury being attenuated. It's simply it is attenuated because it's speculative, because you can't prove it, because of the inferences you have to draw. That's not how the Supreme Court handled it in Alliance. It looked at speculative and attenuation separately, and it said causation requirement rules out attenuated links where it's so far removed from distant, even if predictable, ripple effects that plaintiffs can't establish out of freestanding. And we think that standing theories for deprecated doctors there were relevant here as well. Even if you can predictably say, I as a doctor am going to incur some injury from treating emergency room patients, the court just said that's going to open the floodgates of standing. It's just too attenuated from the person who's actually being affected by the governmental action at issue. And that links, we talk about Kowalski versus Tesmer in our briefing, concept of third-party standing. All of this does kind of wrap together to limit standing where you have governmental action operating on third party. There's a question about ex parte Young. Our position there, to be clear, is that you can't overread ex parte. Ex parte Young, there are essentially two hurdles we think you need to go through. Ex parte Young talks about sovereign immunity, but we don't read ex parte Young itself as providing, for lack of a better word, a cause of action, but simply recognizing that traditional equitable principles also allow plaintiffs, or often allow plaintiffs, to get into court. But we do think you need to satisfy those two separately. So in addition to getting through the ex parte Young hurdle, you also need to be able to look to the, for lack of a better word, common law powers of the federal courts and say those freestanding equitable powers allow us to get into court and seek equitable relief in the absence of statutory cause of action. Yes, they're certainly right there. That has been recognized. The question is what limits, if any, are there on that right? I think my current position is it just goes to the full scope of Article 3, full stop. But I don't think there's any reason or explanation for why that would be the case. We cited Caleb Nelson's article suggesting that it should be much more of a focus on the rights at issue. Are you serving your own right or someone else's? Some essentially in third-party standing principles. There was a question about severability, and severability truly underscores the facial standing, or I'm sorry, the facial challenge requirement here, which is that if the intent of the Texas legislature, even if there could be as-applied challenges to some portion of the statute or even some categories of the statute, the Texas legislature wanted to enforce this statute to the greatest extent possible. So truly it is a no set of circumstances. For these reasons, we would urge the court to reverse our injunction.
Thank you. We appreciate all the arguments in this case and your patience with the court today. Before we stand in recess, for 10 minutes, I hope we're catching up next class.